The recording is on, and we can have our first speaker. So Mary Mulvihill is a project manager for UWB IT, and that's what happens if we don't change slides often enough. Pretty pictures come up, and then you lose your audience.
And then we just hit something, right?
Yep, just tap. Mm-hmm. So Mary, project manager for UWB IT, she tends to get drawn in when the project gets big and complicated and it's going to last a long time. And appreciate your work.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm Mary, and I work in the service management office in UWB IT. And so basically, my role is to kind of lead us on the service management journey. First for UWIT, but also extending out to other areas of the university. So we've been on this journey for quite a while. So what I'll be focusing on today is, first of all, just letting you know about this relationship and this journey that we have had with a specific vendor, and that vendor is ServiceNow. So I'll kind of let you know what this product is, and kind of look at how we view this as a continual improvement effort, kind of working with them to improve their product, because it's not only in our best interest, but in the interest of any other potential user of this product. And ServiceNow is a really big company, so there are lots of potential people that can be affected by the improvement efforts that we partner with ServiceNow on. I'll kind of talk about our style. I call it our Seattle style of partnership. And then just kind of give you a picture of what our current and future state is, you know, where we're at today and where we think we're going. So ServiceNow, it's an enterprise service management platform. And when you think about all of the services that get managed within an enterprise, of course there are IT services, and that's in large part how we use the platform right now. But really, we manage all kinds of services. We use this product actually for our business and finance unit within UWIT, for our org development unit within UWIT. So it doesn't have to be IT specific. It can really be enterprise service management. And so what we did is we have that ServiceNow platform, and then we branded it. We branded it with UW Connect. So what you'll see sometimes if ever you interact with the system, it'll say UW Connect Service Management. If you look real closely, sometimes you'll see ServiceNow in the URL. But that's why the difference in the names that you see there. And we're using it primarily for IT service management, but we will also be using it for HR payroll support. So as we roll out Workday and we roll out a new way of supporting human resources payroll services, we'll actually use this platform to manage all of those support efforts. So IT service management, we use a framework called ITIL. And part of ITIL basically has a kind of a wrapper around everything called continual service improvement. And that improvement model basically says, you know, get an idea as to where you want to go, what's your vision, assess where you're at, develop your strategy and how you're going to get there, check in, see how close you are, how far away you are, and basically kind of keep that momentum going. So this approach works well for accessibility because it's not a one-shot deal. You know, it takes a long time, and the only way that you make progress in this area is by incremental improvement and continuous momentum. So we could kind of use that model here. So in terms of our journey with the UW, and I had to kind of think about this, and I'm like, well, what's our vision? And I'm just like, well, here's my vision. You know, my vision is basically to infuse accessibility best practices and knowledge into the culture of ServiceNow, so not even just UW, but infuse it into their culture so that their development team, their user experience team, their quality assurance team, they just do the right thing, and they do it as often as possible, and they do it for all users. So that's, if I had my lofty vision, that's kind of where we would be. So our approach to help them get there is to partner. We partner with them as a service design partner to show them how to reach my vision. and implement UW workarounds as necessary. And I kind of joke, but it's not just my vision. I mean, basically, it is, it's what I expect of ServiceNow, and how we help them to meet those expectations is to basically bring in the experts, because I'm not an accessibility expert. But we know we have them. You know, I mean, Dan Comden and Hadi Rangan, outstanding resources that we have here at the university. So really it's about connecting the right people in ServiceNow to the right people at the UW to help move us further along in this journey. So where we started was when we went out to go and evaluate products for implementation, we started at the RFP level, at the RFP stage, and we did an accessibility evaluation for all of our final products. And actually, Rick, he helped us with that evaluation. Kind of what we found is that all the products we were looking at, really not very good. So everybody was on a level playing field of not very good. So we identified the gaps. You know, of course, we have to weigh that with all of the other business needs that this platform provides. But at least we had a start to identify what those gaps in accessibility were. And we could establish our priorities. So we decided early on that actually we were going to need to make a pretty big decision, which was to invest in development on our end for improving at least the customer-facing content. So we prioritized that investment of effort. And here's just a sample of one of the workarounds that we implemented. Instead of launching basically the ServiceNow out-of-the-box portal, which was not accessible, did not incorporate best practices for responsive design, not keyboard friendly, we made a decision that we would actually build something out so that at least the customer view could get closer to our standards. And you'll notice we adopted the UW marketing theme, and this has the responsive design capabilities built within it. But that was just kind of one example of where we knew what the gap was, we could understand our environment, and make a decision on implementing the workaround. And we didn't do that in a vacuum. We actually talked with them to understand how they were going to be developing their portal eventually, and we adopted some of that those development practices that they were using. So basically, it's about this education and awareness campaign, and really, I love this quote from Mark Twain, you know, denial ain't just a river in Egypt, because it runs deep in software development. I mean, so many of our early conversations were, no, we're accessible. You know, they really kind of thought that they were. And just helping them understand that, no, they weren't, you know, was really quite a journey and a process and really just took a lot of persistence. And so here's kind of what we did. It's basically at the first conference that we attended, worked through our salesperson who happens to be a really good guy. You know, which I'm really grateful for. Salesperson, really good guy, really. And I said, you know, John, I need to know who is responsible for accessibility in your organization. Of course, they didn't have a person that was designated as responsible for that. But you kind of track it down on the closest you can get. So so that is a suggestion, basically, if you're working with a company, is just to find somebody who you can kind of latch on to. And we basically haven't let him go. And that was probably 3 years ago. So basically, find somebody in the company who understands it, is well-positioned, and is willing to commit to an ongoing collaboration. So our contact, actually, he really does care about this stuff, and he happens to lead the U.S. team. He actually came from a higher ed. He came from Brigham Young, so we kind of understood the importance in higher ed. Then demonstrate for them what's not accessible. Raise awareness about different types of accessibility design issues. It's not just about screen readers. It can be about keyboards. It can be about contrast. Remind them of their legal requirements, but don't like hit them over the head with it. I constantly remind them, but I don't hit them over the head. Then prioritize their improvement needs and document them. So we actually log our backlog in their system, so I know that they have an official record of the problems that we've identified. So, and here's what I kind of call our Seattle style partnership. We are super helpful, and we're relentless. You know, so we're really nice about it, and we just don't let go. So our approach has included building direct relationships. We invite them here. You know, we have these working sessions. We have them experience what's missing. Hadi helps us along in that journey, kind of demonstrating, you know, hey, I can't get past a goal. You may have thought we could. I can't. Hadi actually is meeting with them tomorrow on site because he happens to be down near where they're out in California. So he's going to meet with their dev team and a product manager tomorrow. And this is the second year that he's done that. Annual conferencing, basically I hound people whenever I see them. User groups, I hound people. And then we have regular check-in conference calls. On a monthly basis, we actually meet with our contact to track our progress on all the identified issues. We do maintain that backlog of problem records in their system. And for us, then we get to test some of the pre-release code, which can have some advantages. We kind of get an early preview of maybe some of the UI changes and such. I track people down. Also, we educate other higher ed users, because you want other pressure. You don't want it to be just about the UW. So basically, other higher eds, I kind of make sure that they know what some of the issues are, all wrapped in praise. You know, hey, they're really making a commitment. But pressure from other institutions basically helps. I help the executive level, help them understand, not that they only that they should do the right thing, but basically that if they address this issue, they have a competitive advantage, and to kind of remind them of their inherent risks. And then, of course, at the contract level, like we just are renegotiating our contract right now, and we got as much verbiage as we could in there. We worked with our AG's office to get that in there. Where are we now? We're starting to see results. In our latest release, there are many specific improvements that we actually requested. More improvements will be in the next release. They're developing a new customer-facing portal where they're preparing to launch, and it does have some accessibility features, but they're planning to add more in the next release. So it's on their radar. You know, it's starting to get infused into that culture. And what I'm actually really excited about is that so ServiceNow actually developed their own, and they implemented, an accessibility and inclusive design training program. So they're starting to train their developers on how to do this stuff. Once they train people, then they can start to make it required. And so then we get closer to where we ultimately want them to be, kind of changing their culture. So are we there yet? Did we get there? Nope, not quite. But we've made progress. And basically with our healthy vendor partnership, we're continually improving the product together, and we're getting closer to that vision. Any questions? Got about 5 minutes for them. No questions at all? I should have planted one.
I love you.
Yeah.
If you had to do everything all over again, what would you do differently?
Wave my magic wand and just make it happen. You know what I mean? Because it's hard. I mean, basically, they built a product that didn't have all the essential stuff built in there from the beginning. So some of the stuff they have to go back in there and fix. Some of the stuff they have to actually, because it's on their roadmap to like re-engineer it anyway, we kind of have to live with it until it gets to that point of re-engineering. So, I mean, I guess I wish I could have reached my contact person earlier, you know, because it took some time to kind of figure out what to do. But I just wish everything could happen faster. You know, I'm not sure how I would do it differently, but I do wish it could happen faster.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have members on your team that utilize or do the testing that regularly have to access things with accessibility technology?
So within UWIT, we have the Accessible Technologies group. So Dan Comden and Hadi Rangan. And so they're our experts. But then on in my area, we have outstanding developers who can actually look at it kind of a little closer underneath and help do the translation between our accessibility experts who are not experts in ServiceNow, and then our ServiceNow experts at UW and their ServiceNow experts. So it's kind of it has to be like a blend of those three. Like, how do we use it here? What's the best practice on how to do it right? And then the ServiceNow actual dev team, the people who can speak the dev language. Did that answer your question on the who?
Yeah.
Two things that you mentioned that stand out to me. The first one was the relationship building with the UX team and the product manager or the technical manager for ServiceNow, I think, is key, because when we're working, I've learned that when working with vendor products, you have to get to the actual development team.
Yeah.
You can't go through salespeople, you can't go through customer charge of development, and UI design oftentimes don't have any training
in
accessibility. And so that leads me to wonder, is there a need here at this campus for workshops around accessibility and UI design, and specifically around the technical parts of it, and how do we provide that training, and in what form would that make sense? So mm-hmm. I just ask that question in general.
I say, is it necessary? Yeah, and I'm sure that Dan and Hattie are thinking about it. Maybe you know more of it.
Part of that is what we've been doing in the Accessible Web at U. We've had talks on ARIA, semantic markup, and relationship between UX and accessibility. So there's a forum, but it's informal and it's an interest group. I would love to see, we give classes on asbestos. Why can't we give classes on accessible design? It's just as important.
Mary, can I add into what Rick just said? I'm a web developer, so I remember we invited Rick into one of our design sessions so that we can actually review the accessibility of the web applications that we have developed. Remember that, Rick? I mean, in terms of, for the visually impaired people, the hearing impaired, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. We just want to make sure that our web page is actually accessible to the community. And yeah, so it will be a good practice. I mean, if you're invite web developing or whatever, you might want to invite Rick's. That's the name of your group again?
Well, the accessible web that you use.
There you go.
Yeah. Or we call it a community of practice now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But basically, once we got to Hattie and Dan, then we were in the best camp possible. They can't do that for all of our products.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One other thought is that at present, DoIt, which is part of UWIP, has a person who goes around and connects with different departments and works with them on their websites. That's Anne Marie Golden. If you ask for that kind of review, it could help justify continuing in her position, which is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that info is on the back of this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was pretty cool because when we saw ServiceNow actually sent us a copy of their training program, their slides, and it includes some of the resources that, the UW provided them. Contrast checker, things like that. It's kind of neat.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Well, our next speaker is Krista Greer, Accessible Text and Technology Manager, Disability Resources for Students, a person who is intimately familiar with PDF files. And does enormous work to make them accessible. So,
hi, everyone. My name is Krista. I work at Disability Resources for Students. I just celebrated my fourth anniversary here at the UW, which is a little crazy. And I want, on a personal note, to share how much I love my Fitbit. And this is because, does everybody know what a Fitbit is? It's an activity tracker, and this one tracks my steps, my heart rate, the mileage I've gone, my stairs, and it even has an alarm clock built into it. And the reason why I love the Fitbit is because it gives me data about things I'm doing well and areas where I can improve. And I actually want to do something similar for you regarding data with files that have been distributed through Canvas at the University of Washington. All right, so background. Instructors use Canvas, which is a learning management tool, along with others, to distribute content that students need to interact with. Sometimes students are asked to read a PDF, or complete a worksheet, or interact with an Excel document. And these files are distributed, but they're not always created accessibly, which means that the students I work closely with can't really use them as they are. And so in some ways, they're being left out or starting behind the rest of their peers. And so what has become more of my time is working with these files you know, these individual units that professors are delivering. And sometimes they're good, and sometimes they're not as good. So what I was curious about for the last couple years is how much content are we really looking at? Is this just Krista being whiny, or is there an actual volume issue with the amount of files that are being distributed? And the summary is looking over 8 quarters of data, starting with winter 2014, and then each quarter after that, I collected data on the number of files distributed, the type of file, whether the file was usable for someone who needed text-to-speech technology, whether it was usable for my screen reader users, number of pages was a big one, so lots of different factors I looked at, and I compiled it all. And the summary is, on average, at a course at the UW, if Canvas is used, professors are distributing 35 different files. This includes Word documents, PDFs, Excels, text files, and PowerPoints. On average, that's almost 600 pages of content that students are asked to look at, review, interact with, read, submit, etc. And so I was a little curious, and I wanted to make some really grand assumptions. I thought if this was representative of all the courses at UW, we could say each course that uses Canvas distributes 600 pages. For autumn 2015, we had just over 13,000 courses. So doing the math, that is 7.8 million pages of content that our students are being asked to look at, that virtually any student, disability or not, is being asked to engage with. When I did that number, my heart stopped just a little bit because I am not equipped to convert 7.8 million pages of content by myself. And so this is really designed to spark the conversation of how do we address this as an institution? Do we really believe that students with disabilities have the same right to succeed or fail as any other student? And if we really do believe there should be that equal opportunity, how are we supporting that with the files? So with that in mind, I actually was able to do a survey, and I was able to get information from 50 different faculty members about files that they're using for this term. So we're going to close out of PowerPoint here. And we're going to go to the results. And I'm just going to skim through parts of this to highlight some of the more interesting facets, I thought. First question I asked was the different types of classes. There's a whole mixture from humanities to science to health sciences, CHID, working with Bothell and Tacoma campuses as well. I asked a question about what kind of texts are you requiring students to read. 68% are still using textbooks, but close behind that, 54% are using articles, or they're using these sort of supplementary real cutting-edge, real-life files, journal articles, documents that they want students to engage with. I asked how many are using PDFs. 85% of them said they use PDFs at some point. And then I was curious, well, what ways? And so things like reading a PDF, that's the biggest population. Have students create a PDF is small. Have students complete a PDF is even smaller. And I was curious about the source files, because I've noticed that the quality is very much dependent upon where the source was originally created or found. So a lot of them are actually reusing files from quarter after quarter. Well, to me, doesn't it seem like an easy win to convert their files once and then make sure they use the converted files from here on out? To me, that seems like an easy win. There's lots of other options for that. And then this was interesting. Once somebody found a PDF, did they do any of these basic accessibility checks, like attempt to copy and paste the text? If you remember nothing else from this presentation, remember this. If you can copy and paste the text, a computer, software, text-to-speech, or screen reader can read it. If you can copy and paste, a computer or technology can read it. But virtually nobody does that. Virtually nobody really does anything once they find a PDF. Did they use the built-in accessibility checker in Adobe Acrobat Pro? A lot of them said no. A lot of them said, I don't use Adobe. Then I switched it to talking about Microsoft Word documents. So a lot of faculty members, instructors, are asking students to read as well as to create a Word document. Not surprising. Again, where do you find them? Many of them said, say from previous terms, there's also a good handful that says I'm not using them, or 32%, their option was not listed. So aside from, say from previous quarters, from other instructors, online journals, internet searches, publishers, I have no clue where instructors are getting these Word documents. And again, this one's a little bit more robust with the options. When you create a Word document, what do faculty members do? Most of them are using some kind of bold capitalization, different fonts, different sizes to structure a document, which in fact is not really structuring a document, it's just making it look a little prettier. Virtually no one's using alt text, and this was positive for me. 26% say that they use the built-in features to create numbered lists, so that's good. It's just a whole plethora of things that are going on. And then I was curious, how many of them knew what a heading style was? Another tip, if you use a heading style, you're making it more accessible, right? But you're also making it more usable. I personally, even in my notes, use heading structure. I add in heading styles because I like to skip through the different sections and find exactly what I want quicker, because my time is valuable, as is yours. So I was really pleased by this. About half people said they know what heading styles are. What was interesting is, do you regularly use them? And the results are all over the board. Most of them are not. Some of them, 30% said, I don't know what they are. A lot of folks don't use Microsoft Word, and some of them say they do use, which is great. And then again, do you use the built-in accessibility checker? It's right there. It's part of the program. It's one button. Are you using it? No. And then I asked just some final questions. I was just curious as to their level of knowledge and familiarity with different terminologies, so such as, have they been asked to provide accessible files before? Do they know what a screen reader is? I was actually really surprised and pleased by this. A lot of folks do have an idea of what a screen reader is, at least based on the way this question is worded. Same thing with text-to-speech. They are two different things. Optical character recognition, having the computer take an image and turn it into text. Again, I was very pleased and motivated by this. Speech recognition, same question. And then right here, have you ever referenced the UW accessibility page? Most of them had not. And then I asked a final question about training, what might be the most helpful for them. So I share this data with you not to overwhelm you, although I do apologize if that was the case. It's to, one, I think acknowledge where we are, and also take pride in the fact that a lot of folks do know what these different terminologies are, at least based on the way I worded the questions. And that's a great first step. Once you know what the technology is, I think other things can be built upon that. And so I just leave the question with you. What do we as an institution want to do to address this data? What questions do folks have? Yeah?
So how good are the built-in checkers in for the PDF and Word?
Good question. How good are the built-in checkers in PDF and in Word? They're a lot better than not using them. I would say if you want to be like the cream of the crop, the best of the best, you still do have to do some manual checking. But for the general population's purposes, using the checkers is going to take care of probably about 90-95% of the immediate concerns. Great question. Yes?
So, Krista, did you do a follow-up survey after doing the survey with the faculty? Did they actually change their perspective now they're using all the tools now?
Good question. So I was asked, have I done a follow-up survey? The answer is no, because this survey is still live. And so from about the last 2.5, 3 weeks, have been where results have come in. But I love the idea of a follow-up question at the end to see maybe what has changed. So I like that idea, but unfortunately I have no good response to that question. All right, who else? Yes?
Thanks for the research. So then people come to you, professors, and say, you know, I want to share this. Can you make it more accessible? Is that part of your role? And then do you use that as a teaching moment to?
Oh, yes. Yes. So I was asked, am I the person that instructors can come to ask about accessibility in files? Absolutely. Depending upon if it's a student with a disability in their class, they get top priority versus somebody who is just being really proactive and really focusing on inclusive design. But I absolutely try to use the teaching moments. The line I've said most common in my emails is, if you can copy and paste the text, technology can read it. Because that seems to be like an easy win, and everybody likes to be able to copy and paste their text. I copy and paste text every day. Like, I use it a ton. So, yes, I am a great resource. I have business cards I will hand out. If you're curious and want more information, I'm happy to sit down with you. Yes?
As you work to raise awareness, to what extent do you refer to the laws governing?
Good question. What extent do I refer to the laws when trying to do outreach and training? I really try not to start from a compliance standpoint. It just feels icky, you know? It's just a little too heavy-handed. I think for the most part, everybody wants to do things where they include all students. They don't want to be discriminatory. So I'm not going to start from that place. If there's someone who really is being a little challenging or perhaps stubborn of like, I don't understand, I don't think this makes sense, I think you're just, you know, spouting off your own philosophy, then that's when I say, okay, well, here, let me show you the laws that back up what I'm saying. So. Excellent. All right, well, thank you all. We're going to turn it to our third panelist.
Okay, our third speaker is Gene Markey. A web developer at UW-Bothell IT. And she's also the facilitator of the front-end development community of practice, which is thriving. So, if you find your...
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay? I know if there's a fan in the background, my voice gets lost, so I want to make sure can hear me. Thank you, Rick. And like Rick said, I'm a co-leader of the front-end developers community of practice along with Peter Graff here in front. And please come by our networking session this afternoon if you'd like to learn more about that group. I'm going to do a short talk on building a widget, specifically five development lessons I learned from accessibility reviews. The review sessions are they're led by Hadi Rankin. He calls them Explore with Hadi, usually about once a month. He sends a note out over the Accessible Web distribution group, and it is also mentioned on the handouts here. Hadi wanted to communicate that it's a place to share ideas, best practices, accessibility concerns, potential solutions, and also a place to get feedback and meet your peers and share with them. They also have food, but I am from Bothell. Just so you know, from Bothell we can remote into these meetings. It's very helpful. You can hear, even if you don't bring a project to have reviewed, you can hear, you know, what he's talking about with other projects. Terrell Thompson also often attends those, another expert that campus, that's very helpful. So this is just a quick case study. We're trying to build an accessible tab widget, basically a component for a page with a set of tabs, and when you select the tab, the corresponding content would visually appear below. The important thing to know is that in this case, we were trying to develop source markup to eventually be integrated into our CMS, and so once that component was made, an editor in the CMS could take it and put it on any page within the CMS. So it's one of those things that if we get it right early in the beginning, it could have great impact because it may be used quite a bit across, in this case, the public site. So my first lesson was to embrace ARIA. Now, I've been a developer for 16 years now, and 10 years of that with higher ed, and I've always known accessible development is important, and I've tried to incorporate that throughout the years. But mostly my focus has been on getting the HTML correct and doing that in a way that was accessible. ARIA wasn't heavily on my radar. Even though I had worked on web applications, often those were straightforward forms. Learn from these sessions just how powerful it can be. And just for anyone who doesn't know, ARIA is basically a set of attributes that you can add to the HTML. In this case, I have an example where a list item has an ARIA role, some controls. It's, for example, a tab. It may say, this tab controls the related panel in the page. So it can tell a system device a lot about what's happening with your component or page. And not only to embrace it, but to continue to grow knowledge is one of those things in our profession. Everything changes. Devices change. Specifications change. So it's important just to continue to grow, to keep reading, attend sessions like the one that Hadi hosts, and, you know, check in with the experts if you're not sure about questions on specific use. The second lesson I learned was that it's really important early on to really define what your design pattern is of the thing that you're trying to make. And by design pattern, I'll skip to the next slide. Basically, these are some examples. Is it an accordion? Is it a combo box? Is it a tabs? The reason that's helpful is in the design, in the review itself, the accessibility review, it gives you a good communication thing to say, here I'm trying to do a set of tabs. And that just helps to define that early. But also, if you can identify that pattern early on, and it corresponds with one of the ones that ARIA has already published, you get lots of great documentation, demos that you can model your work off of. So it really kind of jump starts your coding process. And in our case, the visual for the component actually was a little hard to define because it could, if you just look at it, it's not clear, you know, what it is. And I shouldn't say it's not clear, it's just it could lend itself to several different types of patterns, functional patterns. So in this case, it's, you know, is it a carousel? Is it a slideshow? But when we really look at the functionality of it, even though we're working on some visual indicators now, but the functionality basically is you select a tab and then the corresponding content comes below. So lesson three is to create a prototype. If you get your HTML, CSS, JavaScript, ARIA nailed down in that prototype before you try to integrate it into your system, it's just easier. It's easier to iterate off of a prototype than, for example, in our CMS and other CMSs, you have to put it in so many different places and changes are harder. So create a prototype. The other advantage of that is if you do take it to an accessibility review, it helps to focus the review on that component. So in this case, we can just look at the component, not try to also incorporate maybe the context of the site for that review purposes, even though you may want to do that later at some point. Lesson four is to use the auto tools and W3C validator to check work. Learn that the W3C validator does check some ARIA, so it can give good feedback. An interesting one was this, I had put in an unordered list, and then I gave it the role of navigation, and I didn't realize that the ARIA rules supersede the HTML semantics. So I actually was confused in the review because I had heard screen readers read off lists before, but I could see Hadi was working through this, and I couldn't see the list or hear it. And so it turned out that because I had put that role navigation, it kind of took away the normal use of a list. And in this case, it would have been more appropriate for me to put that unordered list in a container that with a role navigation and leave the unordered list as its own semantic value. But you also have to take care in how you interpret some of the warnings. Another example is I saw, it says I don't need a HTML main element if I have it defined as a role or vice versa. So I had taken out the role and I just had the main element. Well, some of the assistive devices are heavily dependent on the ARIA roles. And so that was something to realize. But that was something I wouldn't have known at all without speaking with an expert on it, someone trying to use the screen reader. So that was really helpful. So, and the last one is to review early and often. Put it into the review process into your project timeline. In this case, it was I had built the widget, done my own usual accessibility review. We got it into kind of a beta portion of the site, and then was able to go to these review sessions and learned a ton, rewrote, refactored everything, but haven't had a chance to integrate it back. And if that was all planned into the project timeline, wouldn't have to do that work twice. Once. Even though I started out with the Explore at Hadi meetings, he and Tara are often available for one-on-one consultations, and we sat down for a couple sessions like that, and that was really helpful as well. So, yeah. Any questions?
Jimmy, I do have one. So in your review sessions, would you actually invite students?
Mm-hmm.
You had sessions with Abby and accessibility team, but did you actually start an action?
Oh.
With real students actually accessing the pad?
Right. No, in this case, we didn't do usability tests for this. And Gabby, our talented web designer, and I have talked about that we have done, both of us have done UI, UX, and done that in the past, but this was one of those that just kind of slipped by a little bit. So, yeah, that would be definitely something we'd want to incorporate. The actual, who is the audience for this thing? Or maybe it could be several audiences because of the potential it could be put on any page.
In the length of your career, have you come across the need to compromise between accessibility and then what maybe somewhat of a person was asking for, functionality or look in a way?
I can say positively that I often haven't come across too many scenarios where something couldn't be made accessible. And that is even with me not really having that understanding of the importance of ARIA. But with ARIA, you have great power to make even seemingly inaccessible things accessible. It's harder work. And that's why I always go back to early and often, if you can have control in the beginning. I know a lot of you work with third parties. You know, we do too. You know, having to go back and retrofit, some of that's really difficult. But I can't even come up with an example where it wasn't possible and doable. Maybe longer work depending on how far it went one direction.
Okay. Well, if we could, you know, we're down to our last 3 minutes, I think. If we could just touch this question of the roadmap. A number of ideas have come up. Training was one. Regular reviews from the very beginning. What other thoughts have come to mind for you on how we as a community, university community, can grow into this accessible world of IT?
It would seem my experience with this is some of the presenters, it would seem important to make a case to managers, project managers on up, of the iterative nature of this work, and that sometimes it's hard to predict, especially in the early phases of it, a concrete amount of time that it will take, especially depending on the complexity of what it is that you're building. So having that conversation early with project managers and people on up the chain about the importance of the work, and also just the relative ambiguity and the iterative nature of it, to kind of mitigate any surprises or timeline and deadlines.
Is that something you have to do with every project? Or are you
I would say... I would say, like, yes, but with this, in my experience, because it's, if you're coming into it with not a lot of experience, there's a few more unknowns, and just kind of being clear about that, and the fact that it's even a little bit more iterative than maybe other elements of design work.
Okay.
Mary?
I think other things we need to do, just as a community, is we need to talk about it. You know, just at every... I think we need to help people define their reason for caring about this. Like, for me, I am in this work because it's very personal to me, and it honors someone who I love. But that's not the case for everyone, and I don't think everybody needs to have, like, that type of relationship or desire or need. But I think there does need to be this greater sense of, like, what is your connection to this? Why should you care? Are you motivated solely by it's the right thing to do? Are you motivated by compliance? Are you motivated by keeping your job? Are you motivated to help your boss make institutional change? And so I almost feel like we need to start kind of at the core motivations, that, you know, what is the connection that we have to this work?
Yeah, I've sort of interpreted that a couple ways, but nurturing our initiatives, the steps we take to improve our product, and viewing this as part of just your professional tool set, which it is. So, professional goals anyway. So, So I've reviewed a number of these interfaces of products, and oh man, in many cases those interfaces were worked out about 1998, and they lack standards and code. There's non-validatable code. It's not semantic, and so on. So just get good at your profession, and you'll be well on the way to doing it right. Any other thoughts?
An analogy that I've used for vendors is basically saying, you would never consider building a building without ramps now. You would just what you do. It's just part of what's expected. And so I just kind of say, well, why wouldn't you? I do a little bit of shaming.
Okay, with that, we will end the session. Thank you, Rick, Mary, Jean, and Krista. And I'm supposed to remind you that next in this room is single page applications, avoiding spaghetti code. And that 3 o'clock, we will be having a networking event that includes a community of practice services showcase in the ballroom. Thank you all for coming today. Appreciate your time.